Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Senator Mitt Romney's close call during the January 6th Capitol violence gets a spotlight during this week's impeachment proceedings. With the backing of celebrity Paris Hilton, Utah lawmakers seek to reform the state's troubled teen industry, and Wall Street looks to commodify water in the West. On the phone for this discussion, we have Salt Lake Tribune reporter Lee Davidson. Good morning, Lee. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Roger.
Reporter Jessica Miller. Hey, Jessica, welcome to you.
Good morning.
And editorial page editor George Pyle. Morning, George.
Good morning.
And a little bit later in the show, we will hear from San Juan County reporter Zach Podmore talking about hedge funds and the Colorado River. Listeners, join this discussion with your questions or comments by tweeting to @KCPW or calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. We will begin in the nation's capital and Lee Davidson, the impeachment trial underway in Washington. At the heart of that trial is the storming of the U.S. Capitol by a mob loyal to former President Donald Trump. Part of the presentation that House impeachment managers made this week included footage showing just how close that mob came to many elected officials, and in one instance, to Senator Mitt Romney. Can you tell us about that presentation and what happened in this footage?
Sure. Delegate Stacey Plaskett of the Virgin Islands, she's one of the House managers, she showed a clip where a Capitol officer named Eugene Goodman is running toward the mob to respond to it. And in the hall, he passes Mitt Romney and an aide, and he stops, and he turns Romney around. And Romney, you can see, running off. If Romney had continued on the way he was heading, he would have run into the mob. And, of course, he's an easily recognizable guy. He was the former presidential nominee for Republicans. And the mob likely doesn't like him. He's the one guy, one Republican who voted against Trump in the first impeachment trial. And so he likely would have been in a very bad situation had this officer not essentially saved him.
Yeah, that Capitol Police officer, Officer Eugene Goodman, seems to have been everywhere that day and is being lauded as a sort of hero for having defended elected officials and drawn the mob into other places. What about the trial itself, Lee? I know that Utah's two senators were split on whether it should go forward at all, Senator Romney and Senator Mike Lee. Should we assume that they are split on conviction, or is that jumping the gun here?
It's jumping the gun slightly, but it's probably correct. Romney has said how upset he was watching the videos. He has previously blamed Trump for inciting the riot. In fact, he did that on January 6th in a Senate floor speech, the day of the riot. Lee has been on the other side. He has called the articles of impeachment irresponsible. He's predicted acquittal. And he did things like yesterday, He and two other Republican senators met with the Trump legal team, which is highly unusual for someone sworn to be essentially a juror and impartial. Although in recent history, Republican leader Mitch McConnell, in the first Trump impeachment, said that he was coordinating closely with Trump's legal team. So that happened.
Yeah, that happened. It's sort of, I'm not the first person to observe that this is a political trial and not a criminal one, but those allegations of incitement and the consequences of that outcome, they aren't just political questions. I'm still, we'll come back around to whether or not there's, support to actually convict the president. But just on the topic of Senator Mike Lee, Lee Davidson, the senator has, as you said, defended the former president and has said that the president's language in advance of the storming of the U.S. Capitol is basically all part of the job of a politician or something along those lines. Can you tell us what he said about equating language that Trump used? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, in a variety of interviews, Lee has said that he doesn't feel there's a direct cause from what Trump Trump said to the riots. He, on Fox News this week, was shown clips of several Democratic leaders saying fiery things and was asked if it's different from what Trump said. And Lee responded that it's essentially the same. However, he said, you know, people shouldn't be doing that. They should take a deep breath and essentially take a mulligan. He was highly criticized from what he said, and he said that the press was twisting his words, and he wasn't saying, when he talked about a mulligan, he wasn't referring to Trump, but to the Democratic politicians whose inflammatory comments had just been played for him on the air. But I would note that even in the trial itself, the managers occasionally said things like, some will say Trump should have a mulligan. And I imagine that Lee was probably squirming in his chair and ready to scream when they said that. But
I get it.
It brought a lot of attention to Mr. Lee, among other things he did this week.
Sure. And I understand your point that he, when he's talking about mulligans, is talking as much about rhetoric from Democrats as he is from the president. Lee also made a statement.
That's what he said, anyway.
Okay, yeah. He also made this statement at the end of the first day of the trial that kind of confused people, though he was apparently trying to set the record straight on something. Can you just explain that, Lee Davidson? Senator Lee said that he was misrepresented, misquoted again.
Right. The House managers brought up an incident where during the certification of vote on January 6th, Senator Lee gets a phone call, and he looks at his cell phone, and it says White House. And he answers it, and it's Donald Trump. And Donald Trump thought he was calling Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama. And so Lee looks for him, and he hands the phone off to him. And he kind of stays close. And at one point, the Senate is being evacuated, and so Lee asks for his phone back because he doesn't want to lose it as they're being evacuated. The House managers quoted media reports saying that Lee had kind of heard half of the conversation, and also Rudy Giuliani, Trump's lawyer, had earlier left a voicemail for him, and essentially he was pushing to slow things down. He wasn't so much worried about any danger that senators were worried. He was worried about whether he could block the certification or not. And then managers used that as a sign that Trump wasn't worried about safety of senators. He was still trying to find a way to win the election. Lee jumped up at the end of the day and said, no, what's being attributed to me is wrong. The bit about the phone call was correct, but any interpretation that he made, he's saying that was false. I want it stricken. Senate essentially had to stop for a minute, get together, figure out what to do. And the House managers came back and said, okay, we're happy to have that stricken. We accurately reported what the press was saying, but we'll withdraw it on the grounds that, you know, Senator Lee says it's wrong. And it, frankly, it's much ado about nothing because it's just a very minor part and it doesn't really affect our case.
Sure. And it wasn't the point that impeachment managers were trying to make. Was it not that, as you said, that the president was calling and talking to a supportive senator during the siege instead of telling, you know, the mob to stand down or whatever? Lee made this. Okay, and so they struck it from the record. Maybe I'll bring in George Pyle, editorial page editor, opinion columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. And Lee, I'll put you on hold for just a minute. And George, you know, you're not a sitting senator, so you don't get a vote here. But should the Senate vote to convict the president, in your opinion?
Well, in my opinion, they certainly should. I mean, I don't think there's any question that Donald Trump fomented a violent act aimed at overthrowing the government of the United States, or at least interfering with one of its more important functions, which is electing a president. It goes beyond just his speech that morning, although that's certainly the most visible part of it. There's plenty of evidence that this has been plotted and planned for a long time. Organization is kind of a fancy word for what they are, but the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and people like that had been plotting this and arranging this for a long time, and now in their defense, when they're being dragged before judges, are saying that they were only following orders, that they were doing what the commander-in-chief told them to, that they believed what Trump was saying about the election being stolen, and that this was the last chance to stop that from happening, to storm the Capitol. And the incident with Mitt Romney in the hall shows how close we came to some real violence and some real carnage of our elected officials. Not that the lives of the police officers aren't just as important, but in terms of disrupting the government, that's huge. And it's clear from the, I mean, the talk about the phone call and who called who and what they meant. I mean, just leave disputed version of some of the details. Don't erase the fact that it seems pretty clear that Trump and Giuliani were trying to reach senators inside the Capitol and make sure they continued to stall until the rebellion could take place and the rioters could actually get into the Capitol and change something. It's like Darth Sidious saying, "I have the Senate tied up in procedure." It's a more of a horrible plot than even it seemed on that day. On that day, it just seemed like a bunch of people have gone temporarily mad, and the crowd moved people along and lathered everybody up into a frenzy that maybe they hadn't even planned for. And I'm sure there were a lot of people there and even in the building that day that when they came to Washington didn't anticipate doing any such thing, but just got caught up in the madness of it all.
George, the sort of, you know, the charge of incitement, it's an interesting standard. Way back when, pamphleteers, you know, labor organizers were charged for inciting riots. And I'm not trying to make any, you know, specific equivalency there, but it's interesting. I guess one question that I have is, would the mob have stormed the Capitol if they hadn't been told the story that the election was fraudulent? And I think that, you know, that's the central lie that gets them there. The question is that what this trial is about?
Well, yeah, I think it is what it's about. I think we may, because we have the president out there speaking that morning and saying all the things he did and suggesting that he was going to walk there with them, which, of course, he didn't. He hid back in the White House. If that was all you had, if there wasn't some of the other things they had about the other planning that was going on and collaborating that was going on, that would be a weaker case. Because we all know that this president just pops off and says anything that crosses his mind. So, you know, to say that he's participating in a conspiracy might be giving him too much credit for being able to mount a rational thought. But the other things that went on before, during, and after lend to that. And it also is the kind of thing where, you know, in a criminal trial, it might be hard to prove cause and effect. It might be hard to assess blame. But this, quite pointedly, isn't a criminal trial. It's a decision by the House to impeach and the Senate to convict for having determined that this man is unfit to hold office because of what he did, and because the Constitution specifically says impeachment and conviction means not only being removed from office, but being barred from seeking office, holding any office, elective or appointive, again, indicates that the founders thought that was the point of this, was to remove people not through a criminal proceeding, but through a political proceeding, which isn't a bad word, especially in the eyes of the founders, to disqualify people from public office. You look back at the drafting of the Constitution, they were very worried about, well, I think it was Trevor Noah said, they were the founders were worried about two things, dictators and mob rule. And on January 6th, we had both.
George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist with the Tribune. Lee Davidson, back to you, a reporter with the newspaper. The thinking has been that there won't be enough support to convict, but I'm wondering, you know, after these presentations, are other Republican senators, you know, are they out there reconsidering whether they're going to vote? Is there any kind of inkling as to whether There's a potential for conviction, and then what's the timeline as well, if you could lay that out for us?
Well, most senators who've been interviewed, let me back up. Earlier in the week, there was a 56-44 vote on whether it is constitutional to impeach a former president.
Yeah.
So only six Republicans, including Mitt Romney, voted that it is constitutional. It takes two-thirds to convict in an impeachment trial, meaning they need 17 Republicans. So it doesn't look like a conviction is likely. As senators have been interviewed during the week, a lot of Republicans are still saying things, well, you know, the attack was awful, the riot was awful, but gee, I don't think it's constitutional to impeach a former president. So there's not a lot of movement there that anyone has seen, so an acquittal is still expected. As far as timeline, the Trump legal team is putting on its case today. It is said that it won't take all the time allotted to it, which would leave they are expected just to take today,
okay.
Which leaves tomorrow for written questions from senators, and it may end Saturday, according to a lot of the national press. However, things rarely go as planned, and so I wouldn't be surprised to see it go longer through Sunday and even longer.
Sure. There's so much more to this story, and you know, we talked about that, the central lie that the election was stolen. There's also, of course, the host of bizarre conspiracy theories that a lot of people who were involved in the storming of the Capitol believed. And George Pyle, you know, sometimes conspiracy theories are more exciting than the truth. I don't know where to go with that. Maybe I'll leave you with a final comment on just the whole spectacle of the impeachment and where it's headed before we head to a break.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, acquittal seems likely just because there aren't enough Republicans to stand up and do the right thing. They still seem to be mesmerized by Donald Trump's power. You look at some of the political press today, and they're kind of already looking past this. There are stories today about Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina, UN representative, has been all over the lot on whether she's a Trump supporter or not. And people in the Republican Party who have any ambition of high office in the future are now really kind of in a spot where they are going to have to decide whether they are going to continue to be Trumpists going forward, even without Donald Trump on the scene, or whether they're going to try and live that down and build a new Republican Party. And for those individuals, you know, just looking at their own political future, there are landmines anywhere they go.
All right, some unanswered questions being presented there by George Pyle for the future of a major political party in the United States of America. We need to head to another break, to our first break, and you're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Jessica Miller and Lee Davidson, as well as editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. It is our live Friday morning Utah News Review, and you can join us to offer your comments and questions during this conversation. The number is 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Jessica Miller, Utah's troubled teen industry is now a solidified part of your beat. You have been covering it for a number of years, in fact, and bringing a spotlight to this industry in Utah. This week, a bill that seeks to reform that industry got a hearing, and that hearing had a star witness, and that's not just a figure of speech, a celebrity bringing attention to this. Several parts to this, the bill, the hearing, and the testimony. Let's start with the bill. What would it do, and who is running it, Jessica Miller?
So this is a bill run by Senator Mike McCallie, the Republican from Spanish Fork, and it puts a big emphasis on enhancing the oversight of this troubled teen industry. There is regulations in place right now, but this would increase it where regulators would go into these places four times a year instead of once a year to look for problems. It also puts limitations on when staff members can restrain kids, on the use of seclusion, and on the use of chemical restraints, which is where children are sedated, usually with a shot, until they can't move. It's a way to kind of calm kids down. So it really kind of reins in some of the practices that have been going on in these facilities. And it's in response to people who have said that they've been through these facilities and that they were mistreated and that they were abused. So this kind of puts guardrails around some of those issues that we've been hearing about over the last couple of years.
As I mentioned, Paris Hilton was a resident of one of these facilities in Utah and actually elsewhere in the country. She wasn't the only person to testify in this committee. Others who had witnessed or experienced abuse or neglect in these facilities spoke during this committee hearing. What sorts of experiences, of treatment in these facilities did they describe during this hearing, Jessica?
There are a lot of similarities, and most of the people who have had these experiences, they talk about being taken from their beds in the middle of the night by transporters. Basically, their parents hire people to come take them and bring them to these places. That's very traumatizing. And then they get to these places, and they're strip searched, and they watch other kids being held down, or they're held down themselves. They're often over-medicated so much where they feel like very out of it, or they feel like a zombie. And so a lot of this testimony that we heard was along those lines, just that they'd been in these facilities and that they were very abusive, that staff would harm them and other kids would harm them. And it was just a place that was very traumatizing for these people, even decades after they left those facilities.
We have a clip here, actually, of Paris Hilton describing some of her experiences. Let's take a listen to what she has to say. This is Hilton describing her experience in a facility in Provo during this committee meeting earlier this week.
I was verbally, mentally, and physically abused on a daily basis. I was cut off from the outside world and stripped of all of my human rights. I was not allowed to be myself, hold my own opinions, or even speak. Without a diagnosis, I was forced to consume medication that made me feel numb and exhausted. I didn't breathe fresh air or see the sunlight for 11 months. There was zero privacy. Every time I would use the bathroom or take a shower, it was monitored. At 16 years old, as a child, I felt their piercing eyes staring at my naked body. I was just a kid and felt violated every single day. Although Provo Canyon School marketed itself as a premier treatment center, it was as if it was hell itself was on earth. Children were restrained, hit, thrown into walls, strangled, and sexually abused regularly at Provo.
And Jessica, this is, again, that's Paris Hilton recounting her personal experiences in a so-called troubled teen facility in Utah. Actually, she had similar experiences in Idaho and elsewhere, as I mentioned. In the past, Jessica Miller, Salt Lake Tribune reporter who covers this story, has the industry itself been on the Hill to kind of defend itself? And were they there this week? What's the response been from the industry?
So far for this bill has actually been supportive. This is actually the first time in 15 years that state legislators have actually looked at this issue. So it's hard to say what the past is, because this is just not a conversation that at least has been happening in a public forum up to this point. But so far, the industry has been pretty supportive. Provo Canyon School, so they're supportive of this bill as well. So there doesn't seem to be much opposition so far to putting these guardrails in place.
15 years, you said, since something has been discussed considered up at the legislature on this issue. And this will sound a little bit cynical, Jessica, but is the urgency, the action that's being taken here, is it largely because it's being driven by a celebrity? I mean, albeit one who has a firsthand and very disturbing story of what happened to her. But is that part of where the push is coming from? I mean, is Paris Hilton to be credited with bringing this to lawmakers' attention?
I think that that's fair to say. And also, you know, that we've been working on shining light on some of these issues for the past year or two. Right. Mike McKell credited some of our reporting that we've done that's kind of shed a light on this as well. It was really interesting in that committee hearing to see, like, senators were very surprised that this had been happening in our state. And so I'm not sure if this was just a blind spot that people didn't know this was happening. But at this point, it's hard to ignore. I mean, you've got Paris Hilton having a documentary about this. You've got her at the Hill talking about her experiences. So for legislators to say at this point that they didn't know this was happening, they must know at this point. And it's a conversation that's probably long overdue to have been had.
These facilities, as described in this hearing, they sound a lot like prisons. Maybe I'll bring George Pyle, the editorial page editor, in on this just for a minute, Jessica, and we'll come back to you. George, I am not certain what to ask you here. Reining in the use of medications, you know, documentation of incidents, inspection requirements, you know, more frequent inspections, Jessica points out, curbs on the use of restraints and certain medications, government regulation here. It seems like it's pretty much now universally recognized as needed regulation, thanks to Tribune reporting and some of the spotlight being put on it by a celebrity. George, I'll just let you take it away. What do you think of this?
Well, yeah, I mean, Jessica's reporting has done a lot to bring this to light, but we do live in a society where celebrities get attention and get people to move. I mean, I looked it up. Paris Hilton is 39 years old, and so if this happened to her when she was 16, that was a long time ago, and there's no reason to believe that the way she was treated is any different now than it was then. We've completely ignored this. I mean, you could blame Utah's what they call their pro-business attitude. Pro-business often means the best place to screw the customer and the best place to screw the worker. That's pro-business. But you don't want this kind of reputation for your state, and you would think that you wouldn't want this kind of reputation for your business. I mean, even calling something that is supposed to help troubled individuals turn their lives around. I mean, I don't think really, if it's called an industry, I think right there you should stop and wonder if this is really something that does good for humanity, or is just a way to make money by preying on families who are at their wit's end.
Hey, Jessica Miller, that's kind of an interesting point to bring you back in on the fact that these businesses exist. I think you and I before on the show, maybe even, you know, a year ago or more, have talked about the kind of quote unquote therapy that is happening there. Is there long-term research into whether or not the, again, so-called therapy is beneficial to these so-called troubled teens?
I think it depends on who you ask. There has been some research done funded by the industry, so that there's obviously conflict of interest, but most of those are pretty short term, like in a 6-month period after they left that these kids feel better. There has been research done generally that congregate care for kids is just not the type of treatment that yields good results. Putting a bunch of kids who have similar problems in a facility together, there's just a lot of problems that come along with that, whether it's just not getting individual therapy or the kids kind of acting out on one another. And that, of course, increases the re-traumatization that a lot of these kids have already been through. And now they're in a place where they're being continued to be harmed.
Jessica, this bill that, Senator McKell's bill has advanced further now. It's received unanimous support from the full Senate yesterday. I mean, is it sort of, you never count your chickens, but is it sort of safe to assume that this will pass the legislature?
I'm not sure at this point. I was actually kind of surprised to see the unanimous vote, just because this is an industry that is so huge in Utah and it brings in a lot of money. And so I'm surprised that there wasn't more resistance to kind of, you know, let these private, like the argument to like let these private businesses do their own thing and we shouldn't be kind of putting our hands in private matters. So I was kind of surprised to see this unanimous support, and I guess we'll see if that continues for the House as well.
It's, as you said, a big industry here in Utah, but Utah is obviously not the only state to have these facilities. And Paris Hilton, Jessica, she talked about taking or trying to take these reforms to the federal level as well?
Yeah, that's right. Right now, this is an industry that is really just state-by-state regulations. And so you get places like Utah that become kind of hotspots for this because of our kind of lax regulation. And so she says that she's not stopping with Utah. Her next step is to try to put federal legislation in place so that there's more uniform regulations of this industry, no matter what state someone might be setting up shop in.
You know, you've covered this story for, as I said, for quite a while now, and I'm wondering, Jessica, is it... Well, you know, I think I'm going to leave that question behind and just remind listeners that they can join this conversation. The number to call, 801-355-TALK, or tweet to @KCPW. Jessica, actually, before we head to a break, maybe we can squeeze in just a little bit more legislative reporting that you did this week. A couple of bills related to reforming how police departments operate in the state of Utah. There is a bill that has some clerical implications, but that is meant to have officers think more carefully about pulling out their guns, about drawing their weapons. This is HB 264 by Representative Angela Romero. What would it do?
So this bill, it sounds very simple. It just basically would have an officer, every time they pull a gun out and point at someone, or a taser if they point at someone, they just have to fill out documentation that they did that. And so that's going to create data that shows how often police are pointing their guns at people. A lot of departments do this already, but this is mandated for the state. And there's actually research that's shown that by doing this, it's actually reduced officer shootings, and particularly those shootings where the officer misinterprets whether somebody was armed or not, if they thought they had a gun but they did not. It reduces that and also doesn't increase it hasn't decreased officer safety. So it's a very simple piece of paper that could reduce our police shootings in Utah, which was at a record-tying number last year. So this is trying to get at reducing the number of shootings that we're seeing in the state.
That's it's interesting that there's research showing that it does have an impact on officer behavior. George Pyle, I won't call it a fix, but a simple change to change behavior.
Yes, as Jessica says, some departments are already doing this, and it's kind of a surprise to find out that not everybody is already doing this. This is useful information, and it may well, I mean, you track this completely, and you may well find out that, you know, police officers pull their guns 200 times and only fire them once, or something like that. Then that would be good to know, that just because the police officer is armed doesn't mean he's necessarily going to shoot people. But we should have this information, and yeah, officers should realize, and makes it more difficult to be a police officer, perhaps. But officers should realize that the rest of society cares what they're doing and what they're doing with deadly force and potentially deadly force. Yeah, we need to know this.
Jessica, you also wrote another story about another police reform measure under consideration, this one by Senator Johnny Iwamoto, trying to close a sort of disciplinary loophole for officers. Can you tell us about it?
Yes. Sorry, I'm not as prepared to talk about that one. That was Taylor Stevens was my reporting partner on that, and she wrote that part of that story. So I don't exactly know the details on that.
You're totally fine. It's just one of a number of police reforms that are being that are up for consideration at the state legislative session this session. You know what? We do have to head to another break, and we don't have all that much time left before we head to a feature segment on the Colorado River. And so we're going to take a quick break, and I'll remind listeners that you are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back with our underplayed stories of the week and, again, a feature on Wall Street's Western Water Wager. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Lee Davidson, Jessica Miller, and George Pyle. Every Friday morning, we are live with your local news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. To save time for a recorded segment featuring reporter Zach Podmore, we are wrapping up super early today, but we can't go without offering our choices for underplayed stories of the week. And let's bring Lee Davidson in. And Lee Davidson, how about you kick things off with a pick for underplayed story of the week?
It's a big story, but we haven't talked about it. Sean Means wrote about how Governor Spencer Cox announced that Utah is about to have many mass COVID-19 vaccination sites. He said they'll be in sports arenas, theaters, large parking lots, and the state is even seeking volunteers to help. And with that, he says most adults in Utah should be able to be vaccinated by the end of May if all goes as planned. And then, but the governor added that it rarely goes as planned, but it's some hope on the horizon.
Yeah, I mean, very, very hopeful. Mass vaccinations and a call for volunteers. I was trying to find the website. I'm sure you could. Oh, it's UtahResponds.org is where you can sign up. UtahResponds.org. Thanks for that pick, Lee Davidson. George Pyle, let's go to you. Your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Well, I was just looking online, and I was reminded today is February 12th, and on February 12th in 1809, two of the most important people who ever lived were born on the same day in the same year, Abraham Lincoln and Charles Darwin. And if you Google some of the articles about that coincidence in the Smithsonian Magazine and other places, you'll find out some more things they had in common. I think it's a day to celebrate.
Wow, interesting. All right, happy birthday, Lincoln and Darwin. Jessica Miller, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
I'm sticking with the legislative stories. I wrote a story earlier this week about a bill that passed that now will require police dogs and their handlers to go through training every year. This comes after kind of a reckoning in Salt Lake City this last year where they banned their, or they got rid of their canine apprehension unit after some video surfaced of some questionable arrests where dogs were sicked on suspects when they shouldn't have.
All right, check that out at sltrib.com. Again, some legislative coverage, lots of legislative coverage at the Tribune's website. Find all the stories and everything else that we've been covering on this show over at sltrib.com. Lee, Jessica, and George, all with the paper at the Salt Lake Tribune, that is. Thanks very much for joining the show today.
Thank you.
We are going to wrap up today with Report for America Corps member and Tribune San Juan County reporter Zach Podmore talking about water, Wall Street, and the Colorado River. Take a listen. Zach Podmore, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, as Coleridge, the poet, wrote, money, money everywhere, and none of it to drink. That's how the phrase goes, right? I'm kidding. So, Zach, the reason that I wanted to talk to you was because of the push to turn water in the West, in the Colorado River, in fact, into a tradable Wall Street commodity, something akin to oil or gold. And that is concerning to a lot of people, to water managers and environmentalists. And, we'll get to those concerns. But first, maybe explain where this idea is coming from, Zach. I'm assuming that it's from, the hedge funds themselves.
Yeah, or at least people who are following what hedge funds are doing in the Colorado River Basin and worried that's the ultimate goal. It's a hard story to unpack because it brings in water law and over a century of precedent and the Colorado River Compact, which involves all the states in the Colorado River Basin, and climate change and population growth kind of affecting all those things. So what sparked this story and other similar stories that have come out over the last year is a hedge fund is buying up land along the Colorado-Utah border near Grand Junction, farmland. And right now, the farms have continued to operate as normal, but the hedge fund is saying that they're, looking at making those farms more water efficient. And some people fear the ultimate goal is to send water down to Lake Powell, dry up the farms, send water to Lake Powell, and then sell it to cities during a drought at a big markup and make a lot of money for the hedge funds. That
sell it eventually. Yeah, basically speculating is what we're talking about there.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of people speculating on that speculation that could happen. So the hedge fund, which is called Water Asset Management, has said its goal isn't to create, you know, a private account of water, a pool within a pool, they sometimes call it, in Lake Powell, which would be, you know, a way to measure a private entity's water in the reservoir, which doesn't happen right now and would enable that kind of speculation to occur. Water Asset Management says that's not their goal, but the New York Times reported last month that there are lobbyists working to create those kind of private accounts in Lake Powell, which would enable that sort of speculation to happen.
And that's interesting because water... You know, water is not a normal commodity. It's something that is necessary for life, obviously. I don't need to tell you that. We can't live without it. Wall Street hedge funds, Zach, are not necessarily known for caring about things like, you know, human life or the environment. They have clients who are expecting to earn money. The point being that profit is the only thing that these entities tend to respond to, right? And I guess that's, in some ways, I would imagine that that would be the point that people who would advocate for this kind of water futures market might say is a good thing because it's kind of a way of making things more efficient. Or I don't know, Zach, what is their argument? I guess, what is the idea in a nutshell? Like how would, other than those pools of water being held and then appreciating in value because you could then sell them at a markup, is there an argument for something beneficial here for water in the West that they're making?
Yeah, there is a crisis in the Colorado River Basin right now. Most people acknowledge that, environmental groups, water managers, and this private, you know, equity interests. Lake Powell has been dropping for the last 20 years, and the basin has been in a cycle of drought. What some people call mega drought, or, you know, the new normal in the basin, so that the Lake Powell is never expected to, you know, completely fill up again. And in fact, it's going to continue to decline, according to most projections, including from the federal government. There is a chance that, you know, if this winter stays as dry as it currently is, and we have a repeat next winter, the Glen Canyon Dam could be dangerously close to not being able to generate electricity as soon as 2022. Yeah.
I'm still thinking about the idea of Lake Powell dropping so precariously low that it's not generating electricity. Your article describes the idea of water kind of being trapped there. Can you explain that?
Yeah, that would be if it continued to drop, you know, for several years after that. And there are contingency plans in place to try to prevent that, but it's possible. So if the lake dropped past its intakes, you know, if the reservoir dropped past its intakes for its hydroelectric power generation, it reaches a point called power pool, which you know, would make it so hydroelectricity couldn't be generated anymore. And then if it continued to drop a ways below that, it could get completely below the intakes that allow the dam to release water into the Grand Canyon below. So that's kind of a worst case scenario that's a ways out, but it is something that's possible if the upper basin states and all the interests in the water aren't able to respond to declining flows and continued demand from everyone in the basin. So there's a lot of discussions underway about how to respond to that and what to do to prevent it.
Yeah, I'm sure. You know, you mentioned that there is this sort of idea of Wall Street commodification of water in the Colorado River. Is that happening elsewhere in the Western United States?
Yeah, so this hedge fund, Water Asset Management, has bought up land in 4 states. And is planning to expand that to 6 states. Most of them are in the Colorado River Basin. It does not include Utah. They haven't bought any land in Utah yet that we know about. But Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, California, Nevada, and they have some in Texas as well, which is not in the basin, of course. But the The argument that they're making is that water use currently is incredibly inefficient in agriculture. There are incentives just by the way that the laws are set up that encourage you to use your full water right every year, else you risk using it. So there aren't a lot of incentives to try and, you know, increase efficiency on your farm necessarily. And they're saying that if they were able to, you know, trade water on the market, then those incentives would become, you know, a factor that farmers have to consider more. But, you know, other people see a lot of problems with taking water out of its current status, which is a public resource. The Constitution of the state of Colorado actually, you know, says it in the original state constitution that water needs to be managed as a public resource. It's basically managed as a public resource in Utah. Currently, according to some experts I spoke with, and so this is what they're proposing is massive changes that could have unintended consequences for all sorts of, you know, people who rely on water, which is everybody, beyond the savings and increased efficiency on farms.
Right. And you wrote about, I mean, there's a myriad entities and states involved in water provision, water conservation in our region. It seems like there's pretty widespread opposition to the idea of turning water into a tradable commodity.
Yeah, that's correct. I, you know, didn't get a response from the hedge fund when I reached out for comment, and nobody that I spoke with was very supportive of this idea. And I spoke with people all kind of across the political spectrum and from different backgrounds. Water managers are opposed to it because it, you know, upends the current systems in place for distributing water and, you know, allowing the upper basin states to decide how they're going to meet their obligations to the lower basin states, which is part of the Colorado River Compact of 1922. And then it just threatens to throw a wrench in a lot of just the established conservation work that's underway from all sorts of environmental groups that want to see more water in the river, but don't think this is the way to do it.
Into all of this, Zach, is the notion that those upper basin states that you're talking about, under the 1922 compact, the Colorado River Compact, they believe that they are entitled to more water, that they can develop more water. Some of the people in your article suggest that, you know, paper entitlement doesn't equate to actual water. Can you talk about that? And also, I guess, the sort of, you know, big development plans for water on the Colorado River as they stand.
Yeah, so this is a story that's, you know, been told many times, but basically when the Colorado River Compact of 1922 was being written, it was one of the wettest periods in the basin's history since those flows have been measured. And even going back to, you know, looking at tree ring data and stuff, this is one of the wettest times in the last 1,000 years, I believe. So when they divided up the amount of water that would be, you know, given to the upper basin states and the lower basin states and later to Mexico, they were expecting there to be a lot more water than there actually is. So not only did the flows decline after the 1920s, they've dramatically declined since 2000 with this, you know, 20 some year long drought that we're in. And basically, on paper, it says Utah is entitled to a lot more water than it's currently taking, as are some of the other states, but that water doesn't exist. You know, the Colorado River hasn't reached the ocean regularly since the Glen Canyon Dam was built in the 1960s, or pretty much at all for the last few decades, with a couple exceptions. So if you're diverting more water, it's coming from, you know, another use. It's not like you can take it out of the river. So there are efforts underway in Utah, which have been going on for a long time, to build the Lake Powell pipeline to the St. George area. And some water managers and climate experts and all of the surrounding states around Utah are opposed to that plan, just because they're saying that water isn't there to divert. So this is going to be something to follow over the next couple of years as those plans go forward.
And they are a priority of the new governor of the state of Utah.
That's correct. Yeah. Spencer Cox, the new governor, has identified the Lake Powell pipeline as one of his major priorities. And now there's a new bill in the legislature to create a Colorado River Commission that would be exempt from public records laws, from the Open Meetings Act, which was announced last week. And there's still, questions about what its impact would be on water management, and whether its primary purpose after being created would be to push this Lake Powell pipeline. I don't know the full details of that yet, and I don't know if many people do who haven't, been involved in the writing of this bill. But it's moving very quickly and has been met with some resistance from the Utah Rivers Council and others who fear this would be a place for backdoor dealings outside of public scrutiny that could have big consequences on the environment and on the people of Utah.
Zach Podmore there, taking us from Wall Street and water speculation to the halls of the Utah State Legislature, wrapping up today's episode of Behind the Headlines. You can find Zach's reporting. He dives even deeper on this over at sltrib.com. Podcasts of this show and all of our local programs are at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. Again, Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Tune in every Friday morning at 9 a.m. Have a great weekend.